as soon as Stavanger's VidCam pictures were verified. As he monitored the lobber's automated takeoff for its return flight to Moonbase, Killifer almost hoped that the radiation had ruined the VidCam and the disc would be a blank. What the hell, he told himself. It rankled him, though, that even if he died, young Stavanger would be a fucking hero. Especially if he died. I'm getting a transponder signal, Deems said. The summit of Mount Wasser was below them. Glancing down through the cockpit's transparent bubble, Killifer could glimpse the telescope and other gear that Brennard and Stavanger had left on the mountaintop. Show me, he said to Deems. With the tap of a gloved finger, Deems brought up the transponder signal on the cockpit starscope display of the deeply shadowed ground below them. The screen showed not much more than a blur, with a red dot winking at them. Let's take it down to 500 and hover, Killifer said. That'll burn up a lot of propellant. Deems' face was covered by his helmet visor, but his voice sounded scared. We gotta see the ground before we set down on it, Killifer said. Friggin' starscope sure isn't showing much. Switch to infrared. It's too cold down there in the dark, said Deems. Must be 200 below at least. Switch to infrared, Killifer repeated, louder. Silently, Deems touched the keypad, and the cockpit's main screen showed a false color image of the ground below, mostly deep black. That must be ice, Killifer said. Yeah, it's absorbing the infrared. And the transponder signal's right in the middle of it. They must have landed on the ice, said Deems. Killifer nodded inside his helmet. Landing jets melted the ice under them and they splashed in. Dumb bastards. Good thing the ice isn't too deep. Nah, it must have refrozen as soon as they turned off their rocket engines. Then they must be stuck in it. Yeah, Killifer said disgustedly. And we better make sure we don't get caught in the same stupid trap. Killifer was not primarily a pilot, although over the years at Moonbase he had trained in both lobbers and hoppers and flown them many times. But setting down in pitch darkness in totally unfamiliar territory, no wonder the Japs crashed, he said to himself. Hovering above the ice field while Deems worriedly stared at their fuel gauge, Killifer jinked the lumbering spacecraft sideways, searching for solid ground to land on. Ice field's a lot bigger on this side of the mountain, he muttered. But they won't be able to claim it once we rescue them, huh? That's the theory. The only ground the infrared display showed looked too rough for a landing, strewn with boulders the size of houses. The radio speaker crackled. Anson to Killifer. Yamagata just launched a lobber from Nippon 1 on a trajectory for the polar region. Must be their rescue party. Where are you?
Looking for a place to land without breaking our asses, Killifer replied.
It's important that you get to the Yamagata team before their rescue party does, said Anson.
Yeah, I know. But there doesn't look like much room to put down safely. That's why the Japs crashed in the first place.
There must be some place.
When I find it, I'll let you know. Killifer punched the radio off. Turning to Deems, he added, If we can find a landing spot before we run out of fuel. Deems said, How about right on the edge of the ice? We'll melt it, just like they did.
Okay, but it can't be real deep there. Must be solid ground underneath.
Before Killifer could object, he added, And if there's boulders big enough to give us trouble, they'd probably be poking up above the surface of the ice.
Probably. Killifer muttered.
I don't see any other way, said Deems.
Do you?
Killifer stared at the polished visor of Deems's helmet. He could only make out the vaguest outline of the face inside.
For a scared rabbit, Killifer thought, he's getting pretty gutsy.
Otherwise, we're just going to run out of propellant jerking around looking for a flat spot that isn't here.
Unaccustomed to bold ideas from Deems, Killifer grunted, then mumbled,
Maybe you're right.
Moonbase. It was unusual for a clipper ship to land at Moonbase. Usually the big commercial space liners went only as far as the space stations that hugged Earth in low orbits. Greg watched the main display screen at the spaceport flight control center as the big, cone-shaped Maxwell Hunter settled slowly, silently on its rocket exhaust. More than a dozen others had crowded into the flight control center, too. Like a cruise liner landing in some out-of-the-way port, Greg thought. The natives go down to the dock to watch.
A flexible access tube wormed its way to the Clipper's main airlock while the ship stood on the blast-scarred landing pad, gleaming in the sunlight. Greg knew that the Clipper carried Professor Wilhelm Zimmermann and four of his top aides. Chris Cardenas was on her way to Moonbase also. And Mom. It's going to be a busy few hours here, he said to himself. Greg was shocked when Wilhelm Zimmermann pushed through the airlock hatch at the underground receiving area. He was grossly fat, almost as wide across his soft, sagging middle as he was tall. Bald, jowly, wearing a gray three-piece business suit with the unbuttoned jacket flapping ludicrously, the first thing he did upon setting foot on the underground chamber's rock floor was to reach into his jacket pocket and pull out a long, black, evil-looking cigar. "You can't smoke in here!" Greg shouted, lunging toward him. Zimmermann scowled from beneath bushy gray eyebrows.
"So? Then where?"
"Nowhere in Moonbase. Smoking is strictly prohibited, for safety reasons."
"Nonsense!" Zimmermann snapped. "Like the laws in Switzerland. Pure nonsense!"
He fished in his side pocket and pulled out a gold lighter. Greg gently took the lighter from him. "This is a totally artificial environment," he said. "Smoking is not allowed." Zimmermann's scowl deepened.
"You drag me up here to this cavern. You ask me to perform a miracle for you, and you deny me my only vice?"
His English was heavily accented, but understandable. "I'm afraid so, Professor."
"Professor Doctor."
"No smoking," Greg said somberly, "no matter how many titles you have." Zimmermann looked as if he wanted to turn around and go back to the spacecraft that had brought him. But then he broke into a fleshy grin.
"Very well," he said, suddenly amiable. "Since I have no choice, I will refrain from smoking. But you can't stop me from chewing."
And he clamped his teeth on the fat black cigar. Greg raised his eyes to the rock ceiling. "Come this way, please," he said softly, pointing to the tractor that was waiting to take them to Moonbase proper. "And be careful." He realized that Zimmermann was walking perfectly well alongside him. Looking down, Greg saw that Zimmermann's feet were already shod in weighted lunar boots. His grin turning triumphant, Zimmermann said grandly,
"I am not a complete, how do you say it, tender feet?"
"Where did you get them?" Greg asked. "I didn't know they were available on Earth."
"Mrs. Stavanger had them aboard the ship that took me here. My abductor is very kind to me."
"Abductor?" Greg asked as he helped the obese old man up into the tractor.
"You think I would come to this bunker of my own volition? I have been kidnapped, young man, by a powerful, vicious woman."
Greg gave him a wintry smile. "My mother," he said as he climbed into the driver's seat.
"So?"
Zimmermann looked briefly surprised.
"But your name is not hers."
His smile disappeared. "She remarried after my father died."
"Ah,"
Zimmermann nodded, making his jowls jiggle. As Greg put the tractor in gear and started down the long tunnel, he asked,
"You have prepared the tissue samples for which I asked?"
"The medics will have them for you by the time we get to the infirmary."
"And blood?" "Whole plasma, hemoglobin, this you have available?"
Greg shook his head. "The blood bank here is very small. We're lining up volunteer donors who have the proper blood type."
"We will probably have to replace his entire blood supply."
"Then we'll need more brought up from Earth," Greg said. "In the meantime, you can examine him and get started on your procedures." Zimmermann grunted.
"I will have time to wash my hands, perhaps."
"It's my half-brother who's dying, Professor Doctor. We've got to act quickly."
"Ah," the old man said again. "Very well. The tissue samples are needed so that we can imitate them on the surface of the nanomachines. Otherwise, what is still functioning of his body's immune system will attack the machines when they are injected into his bloodstream."
"I see."
"You don't want his damaged immune system attacking the machines that are trying to save him."
"I understand."
"Blood transfusions immediately. By the time my associates have analyzed the tissue samples, the transfusions must be complete. Then we inject the nanomachines."
"I see," said Greg. Zimmerman lapsed into silence, folding his hands over his